I love the word plop. Just like a small plop of this, and then you plop it in. It's a noun and a verb in my book, apparently.
Hey, Bomb Squad, you're listening to Radio Cherry Bomb, and I'm your host, Carrie Diamond. We're coming to you from Newsstand Studios at Rockefeller Center in the heart of New York City. Today is a fun day because our guest is Anthony Porovsky, who many of you know and love as the food and wine guy from Netflix's Queer Eye. Anthony has a brand new book, Let's Do Dinner, his second cookbook, and it is out September 14th. He joins me in just a bit to talk all about the book and what he's been up to. I'd like to thank our friends at Kerrygold for supporting Radio Cherry Bomb. Kerrygold is the maker of beautiful Irish butter and cheese made from grass-fed dairy. I have actually visited some of the Kerrygold family farms in Ireland and seen firsthand how they make their incredible product. If you haven't tried Kerrygold, look for it the next time you're at your favorite grocery store. And speaking of Kerrygold, tonight is the Cherry Bomb Cheese Ball. Yes, the Cheese Ball, taking place at the Demo Kitchen at the new Ace Hotel Brooklyn. We've got a fun night of fashion and fromage in store for those who are joining us. Our special guest is Marissa Mullen of This Cheese Plate Will Change Your Life. What else? We'll have a special sparkling wine toast with Mum Napa, a cheese tasting with Kerrygold, Cambazola, and Cypress Grove, and a special cheese-inspired dessert reception with Vosges Haute Chocolat and Café Panna. The event is sold out, but you can follow all the action on Instagram. If you're joining us tonight, I will see you soon. And in the meantime, enjoy my chat with Anthony Porovsky. Anthony, welcome to Radio Cherry Bomb.
Thank you for having me.
We are recording this right before you start your book tour. I saw all your dates out there. How does it feel to have book number two's launch right around the corner?
Very different than it did with book one. I think with, you know, with the first book, I didn't really know what to expect because I had never written a cookbook before. I'd never gone on tour for anything before. It was a lot of firsts. With Let's Do Dinner, with my second book, it's been a lot of start-stop, as the entire world has been, I think, you know, for a lot of us. You know, we started on this book. It was actually slated to come out last year. And then, of course, you know, the world took a hold, but it was nice because I got to, you know, go and retest some of the recipes and work on, like, head notes are so important to me because I love to write novels for every single thing. And thank goodness my lovely co-author and dear friend Mindy Fox is not only a great co-author, but she's also a fantastic editor. And on top of that, we had an editor. So I had really strong women around me reminding me that, like, less is more and to, like, cut out a lot of the nonsense. Not everyone needs 10 pages of head notes for every single recipe.
The only person who gets away with that is Nigella. Nigella gets to write a book as a head note.
So I just cocked my head back very dramatically because Feast is one of my favorite, like, my voice shakes when I think about it, because it's just one of the most beautifully written books ever, where she manages to make it all so comforting and homey, but also there's a sensuality in which she writes with that's just like, I love her so much.
I love her so much. She wrote a story for our new issue, which is all about cookbooks and chefs. She's such a beautiful writer that she makes me want to just, like, hang up my hat and not be a writer anymore.
I know. It's like, why am I doing what I'm doing when people like that exist?
Exactly.
That's exactly how I feel.
Oh, well, anyway, your book is wonderful. So I didn't realize it was supposed to come out last year.
Yes, we pushed it forward a little and now it's, you know, coming out this year. And it's a whole new world, even with touring. It's trying to, like, pay attention to everything that's going on in the cities. We're not just able to show up to, you know, larger bookstores and independent bookstores as we wish and throw events and do lines and get to, like, meet and greet and hug every person that comes in. But that said, I'm just, like, really excited to connect with people who are just, like, out there and want to cook. You know, Queer Eye is so fulfilling in so many ways, but it's nice to be able to just kind of, like, do my own thing. And it's kind of like my little side project, if you will, my little solo album.
Absolutely. I mean, you hit the New York Times bestseller list with your last one, so.
I did. No pressure for the second one.
But it is. Okay. It's like making the top 40 with your solo album. So why Let's Do Dinner? Why not another meal? Let's do breakfast. Let's do brunch.
For me personally, I don't know, like it all kind of, two reasons. Well, many reasons for it. But I think when I look back at, you know, childhood, the most important meals of the day were really breakfast and dinner. And breakfast wasn't really about cooking. It was all about a massive fruit board. And my father would slice open a papaya and put fresh lime and some flake salt and, you know, pineapple with mint and all that kind of stuff. But there wasn't that much preparation involved. And then for dinners, my mother was an excellent home cook. And that was really, living in a pretty dysfunctional family, that was like the one moment where we all really got along and where we sat and experienced like a tremendous amount of joy, because we would just be eating really good food and we wouldn't be fighting most of the time. And I just think dinner is something that's so important. And I think, you know, even looking back at, you know, the past year and when people were in quarantine, the obsession with banana bread and bread in general, and people were taking on a lot of these laborious recipes and things and like these big undertakings, things that they've never really made before. I do, like, I'm an optimist, and I feel like it's sort of, I always try to find like the bright side of everything. And I do feel like people, a lot of people who didn't cook previously, who were more accustomed to, you know, ordering delivery or takeout, had more time on their hands. But now as the world kind of opens up and we all go back to work, whether it's virtual or IRL, I want people to like kind of continue that, but in a way, again, that's sustainable. And I think that it's kind of like what I've learned from Queer Eye. Yes, I do like to make my ambitious, you know, recipes on weekends when I have a little bit more time. But like when it comes down to it, dinner is something that, I don't know, like I like to have food that's like really good and well thought out. But at the same time, I don't want it to be too complicated, because the irony of like the life that I have now versus what life used to be like pre-Queer Eye is like, I don't have as much time to cook anymore, but I still want to eat good food. So it's how to get dinner on the table quicker, but without being like five ingredients or less about it. I love those books, but that's just not me. Or like a certain type of cuisine. Yeah.
It's interesting. I hadn't thought about it until you said it, but so many of the articles you read now about how people's lives changed during the pandemic, they talk about actually being home and eating with their spouses, eating with their children, sometimes for the first time in ages. And they always mention dinner. It's not, oh, I got to eat lunch with my kids. I got to eat breakfast with my family. It's always, we got to eat dinner together as a family.
Yeah, I think it's the most important meal. It's like, I've skipped breakfast before and like substituted for like a smoothie. But like, I don't think I've ever skipped a dinner before. That's one meal that I just have not been able to, I'd be miserable. I would go to bed very grouchy. So it's a necessity.
Tell me about those childhood meals. First off, where did you grow up?
So my parents are from Poland. Both my sisters were born there as well. I was the first one in my family born outside of Europe. So I was born in Montreal in Canada. I love Montreal so much. It's an incredibly diverse, multicultural environment. I think that's why I made a decision pretty early on that I was going to live in New York, not only because of personal ambitions, but it's just the diversity. Like that was a norm for me. In elementary school, we had at St. Lawrence, we had this tradition called the Buffet des Nations. And it's the Buffet of Nations. Most of my friends, like my friend Andrew, his mother was Portuguese, his father was Iranian. My friend Nicholas, his mother was Greek, his father was Italian. So you had parents that came from two completely different parts of the world. And you would come to the cafeteria and you would bring food from your respective country and you would just kind of like break bread and share. And so that was kind of like a norm for me, just being exposed to all of those things, even though I have to admit, like I was a pretty picky eater. If it had like melted cheese on it, I was fine, but I was open to all of those things as a kid. So I think that definitely really shaped the way I approach food and the curiosity that I have. And also, you know, my parents as well, it's like we traveled with them. Sure. But like whenever they went on trips together, just the two of them, they would come back. And like when they went to Morocco, we would be having like tagine and there'd be a lot of olives and citrus in our meals for like the following month. Or if they went to the Caribbean, they'd come back and we would have all kinds of different salsas on grilled fish for a while. And that was just, that's how we traveled. It was always about like, where are we going to eat? Where's the market? Like we'd be having breakfast and we'd be talking about what we're going to have for dinner. Few people that I know in my life who are like as obsessed with food as I am. And, you know, particularly my sister and my father are one of them. Like we are definitely the same when it comes to that.
You mentioned that your mom is a very good cook. Did you pick up much from her, or were you not really paying attention to cooking and the kitchen at that point?
Oh, I was paying attention because I wasn't allowed to cook with her. So I would sit like on the other end of the island, and I kind of judged her for a really long time because I didn't understand why she didn't want me to help her. She was very particular and liked things done a certain way. But now I am that exact same person. Like, there's an episode in Salt, Fat, Acid, Heat where Samin talks about how when she has her friends over, she'll have like one person pick the leaves off of cilantro and another person chop so that they feel like they're part of that process. That's so aspirational to me because I'm not that person. Like, I wish I could be, but with my mom, I would basically just watch her as a kid. Whether it was like Christmas Eve dinner and she'd be making ushka, these like tiny little pierogies filled with wild mushrooms that we would go pick in the early, late summer, early fall months in the Eastern townships of Montreal. And one of my sisters was allowed because she was like, she was very good from like a very young age and extremely creative. And so she did her own thing, but I just watched. And I think that actually really helped me because then when I was in college and I was broke and I had a roommate and I had to make food for us because we weren't just going to have Subway and pizza for dinner every day. Like, there were things that I actually remembered, which was really nice. So it all kind of like came back. And then I had like the power of Food Network and YouTube to like go look up whatever it was that I didn't know. And I just kind of figured it out from there.
Where did you go to college?
So in Quebec particularly, it's kind of like there's this in between. There's a college, which was Marianopolis. And then for university, I stayed in Montreal as well, and I studied psychology.
Okay. I loved Montreal. I mean, the food scene hadn't kind of popped the way it has over the past, you know, 10, 20 years back then. But I love that city. All right, let's go back to your cookbook. So I would love to have you walk us through a few recipes. So let's start with one that's a great gateway for the rest of the recipes. Where should people start?
A great gateway. You know, you mentioned right before we started that you were surprised at how many salads there were. And I think I do eat quite a bit of salads. I think that they're so easy for the most part to assemble during the week. Okay. I'm so bad at choosing like a single thing. It's like choosing my babies. But I think the warm kale and chicken salad with toasted hazelnuts and croutons. I love a good hack during the week. And as much as I love to roast my own chicken, I don't always have the time. If you buy a rotisserie chicken, I don't get it flavored with like lemon or anything. I just try to get like the organic one. And I try to get the one with the darkest crispy skin possible on it. You can use it for so many different things. And the warm kale and chicken salad, it was born actually out of a pet peeve of mine. A lot of these fast casual restaurants serve like chopped salads and kale that just like isn't dressed or massaged, and you just feel like a horse. And the key with this is just like a nice warm vinaigrette that softens it that you pour over, because I frankly don't have time to massage kale during the week. And rotisserie chicken is so easy. I mean, for a normal human being, it's like four meals, but I eat a lot, so it's probably like less than two meals, but still.
Rotisserie chickens are the gift that keep on giving, because you can do a million things with it, and then you can use the bones to make stock.
Yes, 100%. We use the rotisserie chicken in kind of like this, it's kind of like a quote unquote braise, like a pappardelle sauce that makes you think of like that classic rabbit sauce. It's really creamy, but use rotisserie chicken. And then we use it in the salad as well. But this salad I love because it kind of checks all the boxes of the things that make me happy. It's sweet from the raisins, and it's got some chili flake for a little bit of heat. And then it's got loads of protein from the chicken.
Why do you have torn croutons?
I was on book tour for book one. And we were in San Francisco and we went to Zuni and had the famous chicken where the juices just pour down and you have these torn croutons, and they're not perfect and square. They're just nice and rough, like these little fragments, and they just soak up all the beautiful juices. So that was like my little homage to that. And I was like, oh, I want to do that. And I want to have it during the week. And I'm not always able to go to San Francisco, or almost ever actually. So
oh, I love that. That's such an iconic dish. So that's so lovely that that's totally like a salad version of the dish. I would eat that every night.
There you go.
Okay, next question. What recipe is the most you?
I would say, I talk about them all the time, but I love them so much. Eggs, the perfect soft scramble. Everyone should know how to make eggs at least two to three different ways. They're cheap. They're packed with protein and omega-3s. They're available like literally everywhere. And if you want to splurge just a couple of extra dollars, and you totally should, go to the farmer's market where the yolks are beautiful and dark, like orangey. And it's like perfect soft scramble that's still nice and runny with some lightly poached shrimp that are just kind of get tossed in with like a little dollop of sour cream. And that for me is the ultimate meal, because I think it comes together in like less than 10 minutes. It's creamy when you make it right. And when you're successful, like the technique in there is not overcooking the eggs. And it's just, it's so satisfying and decadent. And I love shrimp. They just bring me a lot of joy.
Tell us how you do your soft scramble.
So glad you asked. It's so important. Okay.
So don't you get sad when someone serves you like a dry scramble?
That's why I can't order even at diners anymore. It ruins the day because overcooked eggs are just, they become chewy. So over the pandemic, when I was in Austin, I would get obsessed with one thing and try to figure out how to make it perfectly. And scrambled eggs became the thing. And this is actually thanks to my co-author, Mindy Fox. She taught me this. For every egg, I add just shy of a teaspoon of water and I try to keep them at room temp and then whisk them up. That steam apparently really helps when they're cooking, and I don't salt them until later because it does change the flavor a little bit. And then on a pan, like a low to medium heat, if you have a gas range, I would recommend like low because it tends to heat up really quickly. Butter the edges, make sure it goes all the way to the side. I don't want any like crispy egg bits on the end. And then either with wooden or plastic chopsticks or like the very thin part of a spatula, I curdle the hell out of it so that there's a really nice creamy, like a very small curdle to it. And another thing, I know this sounds like so obvious, but what I love about cooking is that like we're constantly learning and like I never have it perfectly and there's always some new technique. I never realized that you can literally lift your pan off of the heat if something is overcooking. So you have to stay like your eyes on the pan because it can overcook, and then just lift it if you feel like it's cooking too much. And then you have to look into the future about a minute and a half. And before you think they're ready, you remove them from the heat because they're going to continue cooking in that pan because it's still hot AF. And then you can fold in if you want to put in like your chives or you want to put in shrimp or whatever it is you want to put in. Simple is always king for me, and I keep it like really nice and easy with just a bit of like flake salt, or I have some really nice za'atar, I'll throw that in there, or I have this black magic oil from a restaurant called Suerte in Austin that I brought back like 8 jars of. That's the most fantastic thing ever, and I put 2 spoons of that. I'll reek of garlic for the rest of the day, but it just makes me really happy.
Okay, you have to tell us what makes this black magic oil magic.
Okay. Well, first of all, they don't sell it anymore. So I convinced them to put it in jars, but apparently they're going to bring it back. And it's, so the restaurant is called Suerte and they do these Suadero tacos, which are braised for like some ridiculous amount of time. And there is this black magic oil that just has, I believe it's fermented garlic. And then one of the chefs mentioned that there's some kind of like a bean paste in it as well. And it's just savory. It's really funky. It's really smoky. And just the perfect amount of salt, and that oil is fantastic. And when the oil just like dribbles down on like between the little crevices of the little curdle of the soft scrambled eggs, it's heaven.
Oh, that sounds so good. A good scrambled egg is a magical thing because even if you don't have time to cook for yourself, whatever's in your fridge, you can throw into a scramble. And there's
absolutely
a nice little healthy meal for yourself that you can literally make in 2 minutes.
And with some things like spinach, you definitely want to wilt it first so that you get rid of like the excess moisture. And like, but yeah, if you have leftovers, it's fantastic. That or like a perfect French omelet that doesn't have any browning along the edges when it's just like really nice and smooth. It's like, what's better than that? What a wonderful way to start the day.
I've been trying to master that Julia Child omelet. Have you ever seen the footage of her making it where she just like throws the pan back and forth across the stovetop and just like beats the heck out of the pan and the omelet? I don't know, it just magically comes together. I have not been able to recreate it. I've gotten close, but I will send you the footage. You can find it on YouTube.
Please.
Just search like Julia Child omelet.
My comparison for like the perfect omelet is I always watch the YouTube video of Jacques Pepin and Julia whenever like he's showing her how to do it. And with kind of like how you hold, like as if you're holding soup, and where you hold the pan and the omelet flips out. I always try to do my best Jacques Pepin impersonation when I make a French omelet.
All right. Which recipe do you think will be the most popular?
This book is definitely on the healthier side without being too precious. Like I don't omit butter or olive oil, but like during the week, I like to like not go too hard. But I also know just from research of like Instagram posts and my first book that it's usually like the decadent thing that gets a lot of excitement. There is it's like a turkey cheeseburger soup. Bear with me. It's the childhood soup that I was never allowed to have that I kind of wanted to create. With these like little rafts with bread and butter pickles and some like melted cheese, kind of like a French onion soup. And it's just tangy. It's acidic. It's cheesy. I love ground meat. ground turkey for me is like, I have it like 2 to 3 times a week because it's just so easy. It freezes well. You can make like a lazy bolognese or like a tomato sauce with it. And it's just such a great ingredient. So I think that one's going to be a bit of like a crowd pleaser. But the sheet pan chicken with bursting grapes and rosemary couldn't be easier to make. With the cookbook, they're like, if people who buy it get like 5 e-cards for recipes. And that's the one that I'm already seeing tagged a lot. So I feel like that one's going to be pretty popular just because it's so easy to come together. And I feel like for a lot of people, adding fruit to meat is kind of like a polarizing thing, but the grapes are just beautiful. And I love rosemary with grapes.
That looks so good. But wait, I want to go back to this turkey cheeseburger soup because that sounds amazing.
Yes.
What is the base of it? Is it like a chicken stock or what do you do?
Yeah, the base is a broth with just a bit of melted cheese and just a lot of ground turkey.
I do love the idea of hacking French onion soup. I'd never really thought about that, but there are a million things you could do.
Well, just the concept of having like soup that's very hot and liquidy to have something like dry, bubbly, crispy cheese on top. It's like cracking a creme brulee and it's so satisfying. And then you make it underneath. Yeah.
When you hear me say French onion soup, does that make you cringe? Are you like, it's not, you don't need to say French.
No, I always say French onion
you
soup.
You do. Okay. I was just thinking, you know, in Montreal, like, why do they call them French fries? Why do they call it French onion soup? Why do they call it French manager?
Oh my gosh, they don't call it. You're right. It's soup à l'oignon gratiné. Yeah, I never even thought of that.
Anyway, another discussion for another day, right? You mentioned Mindy. So I was reading your acknowledgements and your credits, and it seemed like you had an amazing group of women who helped with this book. Can you tell us about your team?
Yes. First and foremost, there's Mindy, who I love so much. I was met her and like, well, virtually during the first book, I was actually filming Queer Eye in Kansas City. And we had a very short deadline for the book. And I didn't have the opportunity to actually cook with her. I was chatting with her recently. And I think the longest call we ever had in one shot was like, it was a little more than 5 hours. And I was trying to figure out what kind of a book I wanted to write. And I would just basically dictate and she would take notes because I've never measured a single thing in my life except when I'm baking. And everything is just like handfuls. And I love the word plop, whatever that means. Just like a small plop of this. And then you plop it in. It's a noun and a verb in my book, apparently. And so we created Antony in the kitchen on the phone, basically. And then we would divide and conquer. And for that book, I had my lovely friend, Beth Barden. She's a chef and restaurateur in Kansas City. She has a wonderful brunch spot called Succotash, where she makes a heirloom tomato lemonade, which is my very favorite drink ever. It's so good. But anyway,
how does one make an heirloom tomato lemonade?
I don't know, but she would bring it to set. And I've been on a lot of sets before where you get really nice meals, but like Beth would literally bring like a vintage, like one of those chicken feeders and just do like the most beautiful salad. And of course, every vegetable was from her garden and she would feed like 50 to 60 people. And then she would have like a cotton candy machine on the side that she bought at some yard sale for $20. And like every meal was always so special. And so I just wanted to be as close to her as possible. So some nights like we would cook together. And then other times when I was shooting 10 to 12 hours, she would get a couple recipes. I would come home and then we would like tweak it and taste it and then recreate it together. So she worked with me there. But for the second book, for Let's Do Dinner, Mindy is based in Portland, Maine. So she came out to New York, stayed here, and she was in my kitchen with me every single day. And it was the most use my kitchen's ever gotten. And that was maybe like some of the happiest months in recent history, just because it was like actually having the smell of food in my home and not like running out and rushing off to speaking engagements and doing all kinds of different things. And we actually got to like test together, which was what I always wanted to do. She recruited our lovely culinary assistant, Sadie, who's a New Yorker. And just like, she's the type of person who's like, you ask her for shrimp and she would just go to like 3 different spots before she found like the perfect shrimp and brought them back. And I learned so much from her. It was just so nice, like being with somebody in the kitchen. It just felt like we were like kids exploring and trying to like figure things out. Cause a lot of the recipes in Let's Do Dinner are like variations of things that I make. Cause a lot of it is just riffing. And then a lot, we just got to kind of like create together and talk about like my time in Japan when we were filming Queer Eye, we were in Japan. And you know, that's how the ochazuke, which is another one of my favorites, not that you asked me for another recipe in the book, but I'll tell you, just a little piece of broiled salmon over a bed of sticky rice. And then it's basically covered in like a wonderful like a green tea jasmine broth with just some scallions, and that's it. And it's like a spa. I can't describe it any other way. So we just got to nerd out over things like that. And I learned so much from Mindy. Like, now I always put a tiny pinch of cayenne in almost everything. It really does make a difference. The way that, like, I always preach the gospel of, like, always have a bowl of lemons and put lemon zest on literally everything. She taught me to do the same thing with cayenne. It just kind of brings everything together and you don't even necessarily feel the heat. I love spice, but not when it's too overwhelming and it just kind of overpowers the dish. So yeah, it was just so nice to, you know, after the first book where it was just all phone calls, to actually cook together. It was really lovely. And it was like the cold months. So it was a lot of fun.
You brought up another great tip with that salmon dish. I learned this from someone when we did the Cherry Bomb cookbook, and she used tea as a broth. And I was like, I never thought of that before. So now if I don't have chicken stock or I don't have, you know, some kind of pre-made broth on hand, I'll just use some kind of tea, because I've always got a ton of tea. I've got like seaweed tea, I've got green tea, I've got all these teas. And it's amazing what you can do with some seafood, rice, and tea.
Totally. My only tip there would be don't make it too concentrated if it's caffeinated and if you're having it at dinner, because you will not go to sleep.
So Anthony, I have to ask, what is up with Queer Eye?
It's a very good question. So I can tell you that we've successfully completed a season, which I don't take completing a season for granted anymore, because a year ago, March of 2020, we had started filming in Austin and we were one day shy of finishing our first episode of the season, and production came to a halt and ended up staying in Austin for 3 months, fostered a dog, life changed, drove back to New York. And then a year later, we went back to finish what we'd started. I'm so glad that we went back to Austin and were able to do that. But I can't say too much about the heroes, obviously. I will say, for anybody who's watched the show, I did have a snot cry season two. I believe it was the last episode. It was the first episode with Mama Tammy, where we were in a church and she said some things that made me very emotional. And I physically wanted to leave the scene, but I couldn't because we were indoors. Well, I had a part two of that meltdown, because the producers, especially with me, they don't tell me very much because I'm very sensitive and I get very affected by people's kindness, especially people who do things for others. Like, we had Yoko-san in Tokyo, who ran a hospice after her sister passed away from cancer, and she didn't want anyone to live through what her sister lived through. So she gave up her own bed and slept under her dining table so she could take care of people who were in this very difficult chapter of their lives. But we had another episode like that where I just completely lost my mind. I can't say anything more about it. I don't know when the season's coming out, although I really hope it's going to be somewhere around the holidays or the beginning of next year. But I know, I wish I had more information for you. They also don't tell me very much because I'm very bad at secrets. And so it's better that they don't tell me.
I will not press you for information, because I would imagine you've also signed a lot that says you can't talk about anything. But we're all really looking forward to the next season. So I'm happy to hear that there is a season in the can. You know, you mentioned you being sensitive. And, you know, one of the things I wanted to ask you, I know mental health is very important to you. LGBTQ plus rights are very important to you.
In terms of, you know, LGBTQIA plus rights, plenty going on in this country as well. But Poland has really taken a lot of my attention and focus recently. There was the first Pride protest ever in a northern town called Białystok about a year and a half ago. And on Twitter, people were tagging me because a lot of these protesters who were protesting very peacefully were getting bags of flour and rocks thrown at them. And they were putting my name up. That was kind of an awakening for me. I didn't realize how bad it really was. And it's really gotten so much worse since.
Tell me about Equiversity Foundation. What's that all about?
So yeah, so Equiversity is basically, they call it a human rights foundation, because if you name anything, whether it's gay or LGBTQ in Poland, it basically gets kiboshed. It's a mix of the Catholic Church and the current government in power, which is a far right-wing government. On paper, it's a human rights foundation, but with a focus on LGBTQIA plus rights. And it's tied into Ali Fornay here in New York, and also working now with All Out, which is an organization worldwide that actually teaches people how to protest peacefully and safely and gets them lawyers when they need, whenever they're basically in trouble for doing the right thing. And so started by Agnieszka Holland, who's a very famous, accomplished director, and her daughter, Mary Komasa, who's a writer, singer and songwriter, and Anya Rubik, who's an activist and a model. And they were all big part of Strajk Kobiet, which is the women's strike in Poland, which was gained a lot of popularity over the past few months. Basically, abortion is fully illegal under almost any circumstance in Poland right now. And so they wanted to start an LGBTQIA plus foundation and reached out to me. It really felt like a perfect fit. So that's been something that I've been really involved with. And I've always had such a weird relationship with my Polish heritage, because as a kid, it was like, it was fine to be Polish. It wasn't awesome. It wasn't terrible. I wasn't ashamed of anything, but it was like, okay. And then when I lived in a pretty rural area in West Virginia for 4 years, you know, bringing kapusta, bringing cabbage to school and bringing hunter stew, like, weren't things that were really cool. And my name was kind of foreign. And suddenly I felt this weird shame about where I came from. And so I completely forgot in Polish. My parents were furious. They sent me back to Montreal. I started taking Polish lessons. I worked in a Polish restaurant that my father worked at when he was my age, then my sisters, my cousins. It's like the rite of passage. If you're ever in Montreal, go to Stash Cafe. The best pierogies, little dough, a lot of meat. Their hunter stew has a lot of meat in it, which a lot of restaurants just kind of fill it up with a lot of cabbage. But anyway, and then I met young people there who were Polish, who were like not embarrassed to be Polish and who are actually kind of proud. And with Equiversity, I feel like it's an opportunity to just kind of feel connected with this country that I wasn't born in, but that I definitely do feel a very strong attachment to and a responsibility to speak up for. Like, halfway throughout the pandemic, I started taking Polish lessons again with this really awesome tutor in Warsaw. I'm still trying to figure out what that is, but I do want to have more of a role in Poland. I feel like I have a responsibility to do that. Did I ever think that I would a few years ago? Definitely not. But it's I think that's one of the gifts and the responsibilities that come with the position that I have with being on Queer Eye and discussing visibility here. I have a responsibility to do that for Polish people in and outside of Poland as well.
How can folks get involved with Equiversity?
Well, it's a nonprofit. They're taking donations. Their Instagram page is very informative. It kind of like updates you on basically everything that's going on and like other groups that you can kind of contact for. It's donation based now. So like, we're really just starting out and just trying to figure out. There was an op-ed in the Washington Post recently, and we're just working on just kind of getting the word out there. I think the first thing is always, like it is with everything, if you're not familiar with it, if you're drawn to it for whatever reason, whether it's personal or you have somebody in your family who's LGBTQIA, or you just believe that like everybody deserves equality, which is what we should all believe, I think. It's an obvious, but not in Poland right now. Then just educate yourself. Just learn about what's going on. I think with me especially, anger really helped me when I learned that there was a Polish newspaper, a very popular one, that was actually passing out LGBT free zones with a big X on it, where businesses were encouraged to put stickers in their windows telling LGBTQ plus people that they were not welcome there. Like, I can only imagine how that would affect me if I were really young and I was questioning my sexuality and I walked into my favorite coffee shop to, you know, get my little pain au chocolat and my cappuccino, and I saw that I wasn't welcome there. Like, that affects your whole life. It affects how you feel about yourself and you're feeling welcome in your own country. But I would just encourage people to educate themselves about it.
The world right now, there's so many things happening around the world and in our own country. It's overwhelming and it's sort of hard to know what to do first and how to make a difference.
Yeah.
So thank you for what you're doing.
Of course. It's tricky, you know, because I went through this period of, you know, the pandemic where I would like spend 10 minutes on CNN and then I would spend like 10 minutes on Fox, and I would just get so angry and so upset that I decided like, no, I need to start doing what I did when I was a kid and like go to the BBC. Yes, everything that's going on in this country is very real. I'm not diminishing that in any way, shape or form, but like, there's a whole world out there. There are a lot of things going on. And the good side of that is that it kind of gives me perspective that there are also good and bad things going on. And it's not just in this country. I'm not like at the center of this thing, that there is a whole world out there. But at the same time, it does get overwhelming when it's sort of like, shit, like there's some really awful stuff going on everywhere. I really struggle with that balance. I really have to limit how much I look at the news, because on one end, I don't want to be ignorant. I want to be knowledgeable about everything that's going on. But if I look at it too much, like that really, it affects my mental health. And then I'm like doubling up on therapy sessions for the week.
Yeah. Well, Anthony, thank you for being a bright spot in this crazy world that we're in right now.
I'm trying. Thank you.
All right. I know we don't have much time left with you, so let's do a speed round. I see you drinking something, coffee or tea?
La Colombe cold brew over ice, black.
Got it. A treasured cookbook in your collection?
Nigella Lawson's Feast.
Most used kitchen implement?
Flat wooden spoon, tongs, and my microplane.
Love it. Fully endorse all three of those. Do you wear an apron or are you no apron?
I never wear an apron because I'm not a chef and I respect chefs and I know them. And whenever someone refers to me as a chef, it just makes me uncomfortable. And I'm like, no, I'm a home cook. And I feel like the apron makes it too official. And I love to mess up my white t-shirts because it's all I ever wear, especially when I'm making like a red sauce.
Have you gotten really good at mise en place?
So much better over time. The best lesson was living in a studio apartment in Clinton Hill for like 7 years and literally having one drawer in my kitchen and a little IKEA island. So I had to figure it out.
What's your kitchen footwear of choice?
White Adidas tube socks.
How about music in the kitchen?
Oh,
yes or no?
Yes, always yes. I have my Apple HomePod and I just play music. If it's Maggie Rogers is always good. I've been listening to Taylor Swift's last two albums.
Oh, but they make me cry. I can't listen to those while I cook. Don't they make you cry?
Not while I'm cooking, but it just puts me in like a mood. I'm a happy sad. I'm like a sad boy. So I like my comfort zone is there. I wore the t-shirts on the show, but I do love The National, anything moody like that. And I love some Miles Davis as well. Kind of Blue, Pharaoh, if I'm like really feeling it. And if I'm like alone in the apartment, I blast some Miles Davis. But those I play on my record player though.
Ooh, okay.
And then nice. I have to go change it every 20 minutes with my dirty hands.
I was
going to
say, you got to keep your hands clean. Yeah.
It's a mess.
But still.
Yeah, but I make it work.
Favorite food as a child?
Favorite food as a child? Frico.
The melted cheese?
With any type of cheese. Melted cheese, but I would put it on a pan. And there was this cheese that we used to get at Costco. We're a big Costco family. So we weren't allowed to have Cheese Whiz, but there's this thing. I don't know if they still make it. It's called Imperial Cheese. It's a red tube with a black lid. And it was like a sharp processed cheddar. And I would, my Frico, I would literally put it in the microwave on a plate and it would get really crispy and the oil just separates. And then I would roll it up and just like eat it like a little, like a pivoting. It's so good.
That sounds great. A dream travel destination.
I would say maybe to experience the Great Migration in Africa. Or since I was a kid, I was obsessed with the Nazca lines in Peru. I think it would be Peru. I've never been to South America and I would love to go.
All right, last question. If you had to be trapped on a desert island with one food celebrity, who would it be and why?
You know what? Because I'm thinking about her now and she just like brings me so much comfort. I think it would be Nigella.
I wouldn't mind being trapped on a desert island with Nigella.
I feel like we'd have a lot of laughs.
You would. You would. You'd probably eat well, although I don't know if Nigella is going to be the one to go like spearfish or do those things.
I would do that. I'm not saying I was about to say I can do that. I definitely cannot, but I would figure it out. I would do anything for her.
Good to know. All right. Well, Anthony, this was a real pleasure. Your book is really wonderful. And I'm so thrilled I got to talk to you finally.
Well, thank you. It was really nice getting to know you.
That's it for today's show. Thank you so much to Anthony Porofsky for joining us. Be sure to check out Anthony's new book, Let's Do Dinner, at your favorite local bookstore. Thank you to Kerrygold for supporting our show. Radio Cherry Bomb is a production of Cherry Bomb Magazine. Want some more Cherry Bomb in your life? Sign up for our newsletter at cherrybomb.com. Radio Cherry Bomb is recorded at Newsstand Studios at Rockefeller Center in New York City. Thank you to Joseph Hazen, studio engineer for Newsstand Studios, and to our assistant producer, Jenna Sadu. Thanks for listening, everybody. You're the bomb.